Hello and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform. Okay, well, Dr. Foreman, thanks so much for taking some time out for me today. I was hoping we could talk to about your paper, you know, just a little bit. It's been 10 years since you wrote your wonderful paper on the progressive roots of school choice, and to me, it still, you know, stands as the primer for anybody who cares about the politics and perceptions of choice. And this sounds like a good basic question to start off with. Can you briefly explain, you know, to our readers and listeners why you wrote it? I mean, why did you feel, you know, compelled to do some research into that vein of education history?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it began because I was working as a public defender in Washington, D.C., and I was representing young people who were charged with crimes, and many of them were not going to school, and sometimes the judges would order them to go to school and say, you know, you have to go to school or I'm going to lock you up. And I remember speaking to one of my clients, and he came back to court and he didn't have his attendance card filled out. And I said, you know, the judge is going to lock you up. Why aren't you going to school? And he said, Mr. Foreman, you know, you should come to school with me and then you'll see why I don't go. And I took him up on that, and he was going to an alternative school, which is, again, in concept, I'm a supporter of alternative schools, but this one was doing exactly what you wouldn't want to do, which is it was taking the kids who needed the most help and the best teachers and the smallest classes and the most rigorous curriculum, and instead of giving them all of that, it was giving them the worst of everything. It was giving them big classes and the teachers that nobody else in the system wanted, and a dumbed-down curriculum. They had the only trade that they could learn in this school was barbering. And, you know, I'm just, you know, as a black man, I rely on my barber. And so I think that's an honorable trade. But the idea that that would be the only trade that you would offer in a vocational program was, I just thought, appalling. And so I was very frustrated by the way the system, the school system, was treating the kids that I cared the most about and the kids that I feel like as a society we should care about. And so I started thinking about alternatives, about a private school or a charter school. Was there something that I could do to try to create an opportunity that didn't exist for clients like the young man I just mentioned to you? And I immediately encountered, and this was, you know, almost more than 15 years ago now, a lot of opposition from people who said, this was in the very early days in charter schools, and people said, well, you know, I don't trust school choice because school choice was used after Brown versus Board of Education as a way for white families who didn't want to send their children to integrated schools to avoid the public school system. And of course, as a lawyer and a law professor, I knew those cases. I knew those cases from the 1960s. And right. I knew that that was true. You know, I knew that they were right when people said that. But I also knew from African American studies and other reading that I had done that that wasn't the whole story. That wasn't the whole story of school choice, because I knew that African Americans had never been well served by the state in our nation. We've always had to deal with second class status. So it seemed impossible to me to think that over all of those years, African Americans had never organized themselves to try to create better opportunities outside of what the state was providing them. So that was my idea. My thesis was there had to be an alternative history. There had to be a history of African Americans who were not relying on the government and were trying to organize themselves to create schools to educate their children when the state was denying them the same.
Right.
And so that's what I then set about trying to research.
Well, Dr. Foreman, I want to ask you in a second about why these perceptions matter so much, you know, as to whether the pedigree of choice is right or left. But before I go there, I want to ask you this, and you touch on this a little bit in your paper, but I don't know that you delve fully into this, and that's why there is this oversight in the first place. I mean, why do you think it is that so much of this history, why has it been so buried and overlooked?
Well, so I think there might be a different answer 15 years ago from today, but let me start with 15 years ago. I think that 15 years ago, the answer was the resistance to Brown. I mean, the dominant, when we think of racial justice struggle in this country, the first one that comes to mind for most people is the civil rights movement. And Brown versus the Board of Education is part of that. And so I think the fact that segregation academies were created throughout the South in the 1960s and into the 1970s that's real. That's true. That happened. And I think it's dominated people's understanding of choice. When they look at choice through the racial lens, the first thing they think of is that history, because that history owns our consciousness so thoroughly.
Well, here's the more important question. Why does it matter, if choice is viewed, in the popular narrative as being left or right? I mean, right now it's mostly viewed as being right. I still think that's the case. I'd like to think that that's changing and that a more fuller picture is emerging once again because of efforts like yours. But it still is, considered mostly a right-wing thing. Why does that matter?
Well, it matters a lot because it influences how we understand the issue, and it also influences who's likely to end up. Our understanding of the history influences the direction that the issue goes. So in other words, if people think of this as a right-wing movement, then it will become one.
Right.
If people who have an equality orientation and a civil rights orientation see themselves as on the outside of the movement for school choice, then the only people who are going to be left are people who have different motivations. And there are people who have different motivations, right? I mean, it's true. There are people that want to dismantle unions in our country. There are people who want to privatize public education. That's not a lie. That's true. There are those people.
Right.
And so the question is going to be, who owns the movement? Who directs the movement? Who's dominant? Whose educational vision leads the way? And so the history matters, because if progressives take ourselves out of the effort, then it will become the very thing that we mistakenly thought it was historically, and our worst fears will become true.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes, thank you. Perfect. Exactly right.
Well, Dr. Forman, in the 10 years since you wrote this great paper, do you think things have gotten better? I mean, is there a fuller portrait of school choice and its roots and its supporters emerging now? I mean, do you see any hopeful signs that what you hoped to spark with your paper 10 years ago has come to pass, or are things still looking bleak?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that there definitely are people who, I think there's a whole cohort, really a generation of people, many of them people of color, who have gone in, especially to teaching and to an extent into school leadership as well, who go into the work with a progressive civil rights, racial justice framework. I think that, and that's the thing that is the most inspiring to me. I remember being on a panel some years ago, and it was a panel that was organized by Teach for America. And I was on the panel with Richard Rothstein, whose work I actually am a fan of, although I know that he, you know, he's controversial in many quarters. But I was there because I, you know, Wendy Kopp asked me to be there. I think to be sort of an interlocutor and an honest broker, somebody who would ask him hard questions, but would ask him fair questions. And one of the things that I found so interesting and inspiring, in a sense, was that after it was over, all of these black women, and a couple black men, but I don't know, 10 black women, all approached him afterwards. And they all were rushing up to him to tell him that his account of choice was not the world they were living in. And they told these moving stories about themselves having been denied educational opportunity. And that's why they wanted to go into teaching.
As a last question, let me try to phrase it this way. So, you know, at the same time, you know, some of us are trying to do our best Dr. Foreman impersonations and tell our readers about school choice in the left, things are changing on the ground. And by that I mean, you know, more and more low-income parents, parents of color, are, you know, increasingly embracing school choice. I mean, I don't know if they view it that way, but increasingly we see, you know, low-income parents and minority parents enrolling their kids in charter schools, using vouchers, using tax credit scholarships. In Florida this year, the program I work for, which administers the tax credit scholarship program down here, we've got 77,000 students in the program, and three-quarters of them are students of color. And so I guess I wonder how long this perception of school choice as a right-wing thing can continue to hold sway when more and more people who are, you know, who don't seem to be right wing, are flocking to choice and embracing and enrolling their kids in it, and, you know, increasingly also standing up and defending it.
I think you're onto something, and I think that presents a great opportunity. But I think there are two other things that have to happen along with the numbers of parents and kids to create the sort of change that you are describing, you want, and that I know I very much want. Number one has to do with leadership. One of my points that I make to those in the movement for choice is it cannot be the case that the schools are schools for black and Latino youngsters, for low-income kids, and that the leadership of organizations, the leadership of schools, the leadership of the advocacy infrastructure that works in state capitals and works in Washington, that leadership remains overwhelmingly white. That as long as that dynamic is in place, as long as that dynamic remains unchanged, there are going to be people who I think are going to point to, and in some instances I would say not inaccurately, the movement and say, well, if you're really about these families, then you need to allow folks who look like these families and folks who are from some of these families to run these organizations. And so that's number one.
Okay.
I think that has to change. It hasn't changed yet. It has not changed yet. Every time I go to a conference, I am appalled by how invisible almost the folks of color can be at the top level of leadership. And that, to be clear, and let me be crystal clear about this, I in no way am I suggesting that people, that white folks, that people who are from privileged backgrounds of whatever races, don't have a role to play and cannot be leaders. That's not my point. My point, though, is the overall leadership picture needs to change. Because right now, it's almost lily white. So that's a problem.
Dr. Foreman, this has been great. I didn't mean to keep you on the phone this long, but This has been absolutely wonderful. I'm so grateful that you were able to find some time to talk to me today.
Absolutely. Listen, I appreciate it.